Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Podcast. Today is Thursday, August 9th, 2018. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. Join us at CommentaryMagazine.com. Get a few free reads, then subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. We are closing our September issue right now, Harvest of Treasures. Right, Abe? What do we have there? We got Peter Fever and Hal Brands on whether NATO can be saved. We have the first appearance in the pages of Commentary of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. An essay from a memoir never before translated into English about his first days in the West after his forced exile from the Soviet Union in 1974.
Fred Kagan on a successful Iran strategy.
A remarkable essay about the film director Ingmar Bergman, whose centenary we're celebrating this year. And a really terrific essay by Jonathan Foreman on the Labour Party's anti-Semitism problem in Britain. Joseph Epstein on What is Charm.
Laha Farkov on the
nation state law. Right. Christine Rosen on the rise of acceptable man hatred in the world of feminism. Anyway, it's just it's very rich and very long, and you will be able to read it next week. That was Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Noah Rothman, our associate editor, right next to me. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Saurabh Amari is out today. So we ended the last podcast by saying we would take up on this podcast the question of how the parties will react to unfavorable results in the 2018 election, or maybe the 2020 election, the two parties in two different ways. Since we talked on Monday, we had midterm and special election. We had midterm primary and special election results in Ohio, Missouri, Washington State. I think those are really the three. Kansas, And I fair to say that the results portend a happy evening for Democrats on Election Day in November and an unhappy evening for Republicans. The obvious one, Noah, was the still undecided race in the special election in the Ohio 12th Congressional District, which was a Trump plus 11 district in 2016. And in which now, I think 1,400 votes now separate the Republican and the Democrat, thus indicating essentially sort of 10% rise in Democratic participation and a corresponding 10% drop in support on the Republican side.
There are more results from Tuesday that deserve more attention, but this is a really interesting district for a lot of reasons, in part because it was a display of how Donald Trump had a new coalition, a broader coalition than the Republican Party. This district has a plus 7 PVI, the partisan voting index. The Cook Political Report does these indices, and that's one of them, and says, you know, this is how partisan this district is relative to the country, which is zero. And so Trump outperformed the partisan baseline for a Republican in this district because he drew in voters who don't traditionally vote Republican. The snapback that we've seen is what a lot of people thought was going to happen. A lot of people like us who were afraid of what the post-Trump Republican Party would look like and how it would repulse, for example, the kind of voters who made up the traditional base of the Republican Party, like this district's voters. Very educated, way more highly educated, way more degree holders in this district than is the national average, slightly above average on the national, above income, middle class, white, educated voters, used to be suburban, ex-urban, used to be the Republican base, and a lot of them are fleeing. And so this is the fear. And if that is repeated across the board, of course, the swing is never uniform across the board. But if it were, then it would be a really, really bad day for Republicans in November. Some other races on Tuesday. that were really important to judge how the national environment is going to look occurred in Washington State, where they have this weird two-party system where it's kind of a primary, but it's not. Everybody gets the same pile of votes, and the top two winners and top two vote-getters advance to the general election, and it's nonpartisan. So it can be Republican and Democratic, and it usually splits. And Republicans usually kind of outperform on the primary day because it's like a dry run for election day.
They outperform on the primary day, and then except in a few cases, underperform on election day. Okay. Or, I mean, it's pretty much a red state.
Right. Blue state.
Blue state.
Washington.
Right. Sorry. Blue.
So, yes, there were two Republicans in Republican districts. Blocking on her name. Herrera something. That's the
main name. And then McMorris Rodgers.
Well, McMorris Rodgers is the big one. She's the fourth-ranking Republican in the House. And she pulled out a squeaker of a primary victory. Now, she would have advanced anyway, but it was she had beat the Democrat in this primary by 0.4 points, which is a really, really bad omen for her and a
really
whole lot of other Republicans.
It really does suggest that she's not going to make it in November because presumably the turnout in the November election will be more heavily Democratic than the midterm. I'm going to read one thing to you, and let's try to translate this. Excuse me, from Dave Wasserman, who is an election analyst. So, Democrats outperformed the Cook political PVI by an average of 8% in this cycle's 9 House special elections, where both parties appeared on the final ballot. So PVI is the presidential, in other words, what this means is that based on the 2016 results, in 9 House special elections, Democrats did 8 percentage points better than they did in those districts in 2016. So if that's not a portent of a terrible November day for Republicans, I don't know what is that number, that aggregation. So instead of dwelling on this fact that we are now seeing real meat on the bones, I've had a couple of people say to me that there is not a member of Congress that anyone takes seriously who does not now believe that the House is lost to Republicans in November. Of course, most people thought that Trump wasn't going to win in 2016. That's what people say. But of course, there were no pieces of data along the way, other presidential elections happening along the way between 2016, between 2014 and 2016 to help show you what was going to happen with Trump.
Another thing, along with the fact that since early 2017, with specials, with off-year elections, we've had a pretty consistent swing across the board towards Democrats. The polls have been really, really good this cycle. Mm-hmm. As in specials, they've been dead on.
Particularly in this Ohio special, where basically it was the last two polls, one had the Republican up by one, the other poll had the Democrat up by one, and the fact is it's a dead heat. So the polling, you don't expect polling to zero in. It's each poll has a margin of error of 3 points either way. So this
even
is
in primaries,
accurate,
which are really tough to poll, a small universe of voters, they've been close.
And you don't know who's going to come out on an August day. And the election is meaningless. That's the joke of all this, is that this election is entirely symbolic because they have to rerun it in November. The special literally, since there may end up being a recount, it could be the case that by the time they certify a winner, that person will be sworn in and will serve for exactly 6 weeks before the next election. So when you heard them saying, I'm going to go to Washington and help the Donald Trump agenda, it's like you're not going anywhere to do anything, basically, unless you can do this again. And we don't know what apparently the thought is that the November election might modestly benefit the Republican Balderson, because turnout was incredibly high in the Democratic areas of the district and not so high in the Republican areas, and since they know that they have to target those areas to get a few thousand more votes, they can probably do that effectively. So, and whereas it'll be harder to get hot turnout higher than the Democrat in the Democrat areas than happened on Tuesday night. All right, so here's the story. So we were thinking, one of the things we were talking about before we did the last podcast was what would happen. This is sort of a consuming obsession of mine as a sort of melodramatic person who likes to think melodramatically about the future. What would happen if, after everything that we've seen, after everything that's gone on since November, the Women's March, the the reaction to Charlottesville, the reaction to Parkland, the special election in Georgia, in which a Democrat did 17 points better than anybody that he should have done, victories in the Alabama Senate race and in the Pennsylvania special election in the House, every House race being way closer, all of that, that Democrats only need 23 seats to take the House and that they come up short. After all this, the money that's being raised, the new candidates, all the energy, all the enthusiasm, and they just can't get over the hill, and they win maybe 17 seats or 16 seats, and they don't get over the hill. And what the mood is, what the feeling would be in Democratic, liberal, leftist, anti-Trump circles at the failure to secure this very specific political victory. Now, the results on Tuesday night suggest that this scenario that we're about to lay out is unlikely to have happened. But Trump is, after all, tweeting that there's going to be a red wave. So let's assume that he has a magical formula to somehow stave off this disaster. And though there may not be a red wave, he does manage to keep, he and the Republicans manage to keep their losses modest and to hold the House. So in that, let's put on our, let's look into our crystal balls and say, what will the result be in mood and spirit terms among Democrats, leftists, liberals, and anti-Trumpers, who are all different? They're not, they overlap, but they're not all the same people. Noah, what do you think?
Well, for evidence of my fantastical assertion, I will cite the collective liberal and Democratic response, which did not vary all that dramatically, to the news that Donald Trump would get a second Supreme Court appointment. The reaction was apocalyptic. It was genuine and heartfelt among the part of liberals that the country that they love and understand and cherish was going away, and that the political process had failed them.
Well, they don't love and cherish it that much, but okay.
In their the country that they have in their heads. That conception of America was disappearing, and that there was no recourse to them, that they had no political alternative or a political mechanism to which they could appeal for redress. They were just out in the cold. And that feeling would be magnified by orders of magnitude in the event that they, after all this, for who Donald Trump is and for what the Republicans are, and after all that, the feeling that they're, and they will have generated enough turnout in this scenario to affect a really big political event, just not big enough. And they will say, okay, well, the political process doesn't work for us anymore. Gerrymandering has locked us out. Voter suppression is keeping us from impacting the political process in a way that is commensurate with our numerical strength.
Fox News, Sinclair,
right? And these
Cokes,
will all be
the
very
Cokes. Don't forget the Cokes.
There will be, and these are all going to be very convincing messages, and they will, for many, they will be cause for despair and fatalism and dropping out of the political process. But for others, dropping out of the political process won't necessarily just be staying home and watching reality television. They will appeal to extraordinary measures to affect political outcomes. They will appear in the streets. They will march in the streets. They will engage in civil disobedience. But there will be other elements, the anti-fascist elements, who will engage in violence, property destruction, sabotage, and possibly even physical violence in a mass scale in an organized way. And we saw some of that in 2016.
This is an important point. Because Noah, you wrote, we published an article by you on this point about leftist violence in the accompanying the rise of Trump. In, was it September of 2016?
It was throughout 2016.
No, but we published an actual long article in the magazine, August of, right, the July-August issue of 2016.
No, you're right. Yeah, it was July-August. Yeah.
Anyway, about, you know, these little noted, you know, obviously every piece of coverage that was garnered on in Charlottesville was deserved, and I'm not complaining that that was highlighted, but you did have outbreaks of anti- right-wing violence, in particularly in California, very harsh violence that at which cops basically turn a, you know, to which cops turn a blind eye, particularly.
Cops were targeted.
Cops were targeted, and cops turned a blind eye when, and of course we have the, you know, Ben Shapiro on campus.
But it began in Chicago. I mean, right. I credit Donald Trump starting it. I think Donald Trump instigated this violence at his rallies.
This rally that he had in Chicago
But the counter demonstration, the counter violence, which was organized at the University of Chicago and infiltrated this event and targeted Trump supporters with violence, targeted police with violence.
I think that was the University of Illinois Chicago Circle, by the way. I just want to specify that because as a graduate of the University of Chicago, you couldn't get University of Chicago to have enough enthusiasm.
So that was repeated in events in
Antifa riot.
In California and Arizona and elsewhere, there were events in which organized mobs targeted Donald Trump supporters with actual violence, and it was little covered. And then in the Trump era, we have seen these two identitarian groups, the anti-fascist right and the alt-right, or the anti-fascist left and the alt-right, coming to blows in the streets.
And we saw a case, again, sort of somewhat unheralded because of the nature of liberal media bias, of the lunatic who shot up the Republican softball team, who was driven to do so in part by, or his drive was accompanied by intense consumption of left-wing anti-Trump media and anti-Republican media.
I have to say, though, I'm not at all convinced that Democratic success in the midterms will have a sort of moderating effect or a becoming effect on the activist left at all. I think they are still deeply smarting from 2016 and may sort of take on the mindset that now our work is cut out for us. Now we have work to do. We've now got a foothold in politics, and we need to use it. And I think also if you look at the Republican midterm success during the Obama years, did this have a moderating effect on right wing activism?
I think it had a moderating effect on, let's say, the possibility of right wing violence in the streets, that there was political action to be taken. That's, I think, what we're talking about. Is I'm not saying that the left will go quiescent. I mean, they will do whatever they can in the way that they do it. It's a question of whether or not something will break, that a dam will break, that might lead to more to political violence being thinkable in this sense, which is that you say to yourself, "We did everything we could. We raised all this money. We put all these candidates in place. You know, we voted, we held our nose and voted for people who were too right-wing for us because they were on the Democratic line, whatever, and Trump still has the House and the Senate, and he's not going to get impeached, and he's not going to get removed, and the Republicans are going to act as a blocking tackle, and the media can't do anything, and Mueller's going to be useless, and we got to do something else." And the something else, whenever that emotion rises, is always something
so
you know, if you take the analogy to the late 60s, you would have, you know, domestic terrorist groups forming on, you know, we have this sort of rise of socialism, right? That's all everyone's talking about, the rise of socialism and how people like socialism because they don't know what socialism is. But, you know, maybe the taste for socialism will start getting mixed together with the taste for a revolutionary romantic socialism of the Che Guevara Maoist variety that so stimulated people in the 1960s, and then you'll have army recruiting stations being blown up and townhouses going up in flames in Greenwich Village because people are making bombs. Now, I'm not saying this is going to happen.
That's worth exploring, that the evolutionary trajectory of how the anti-war movement split and became violent in the late 1960s, early 1970s, after 68. What happened in 68 was real political engagement on the part of these same people, and they were all uniform. They were all engaging in traditional political activity for their particular candidates. And in the event that there was a Democratic victory, even if it was a Humphrey victory, they would have continued to be engaged in the political process because they were already there. They had a buy-in. They were part of the coalition. And that's what I think we're going to see from the anti-Trump movement, the anti-Trump left, the extreme anti-Trump left in 2019, 2020, because the presidential primaries get underway the day after the election is over. And then they are engaged. They have a buy-in in the political process. They want to make sure that their candidate emerges from that process. And to be outside the political process would deprive them of that opportunity. Now, if things go their way in November. Now, what happened to the Weather Underground was that they lost the presidential election. And there was a big debate within the anti-war movement over how it should proceed. It wasn't sotto voce, and it wasn't spontaneous. This happened right in front of our eyes. And we haven't really seen that intra-party debate on the left about extraordinary measures yet.
Right. Well, there was also the terms and the situations were so different because we were at war. And so the extremes of the anti-war movement to demonstrate their hatred of the war and American imperialism that supposedly generated the war and all of that literally went to the other side and became outright supporters of the regime that there were 500,000 men in Vietnam fighting. And
so you can envision that kind of extremism happening, but right now we're in the clean for Gene phase.
Right, but there are no large national traumas going on at the time that all of this is happening, right? We don't have the assassinations of RFK and Martin Luther King Jr. hard upon each other in 2.5 months. We don't have the burning, you know, sort of the burning of 11 cities in response to the King assassination. We don't have the, you know, no riot in Chicago 7 riot in Grand Park around the Democratic Convention. We don't have large-scale American unrest. However, we could, in theory, have it at some point, because the logic, in my view, and Abe, I think you should, maybe I'll ask you to extrapolate on this, the logic of the anti-Trump position is, if he is not stopped, and if the Republican apologists and enablers are not stopped, the country and the world are going to be ruined. And when the country and the world are going to be ruined, that's when you start in the, well, they didn't stop Hitler at the Reichstag fire. You know, would you go back in time and assassinate Hitler if you could? You know, and we're standing here, Pastor Niemöller's poem, all of that.
I want to pick up that point. I just want to add, one more point to your point about how certain things are not happening currently that would contribute to potential violence. This is a point that you've made before, John. Also, there are not the concurrent in real time foreign leftist revolutionaries committing acts of violence on which to model themselves, on which American leftists can model themselves at the time, as there was in the 60s. That's another element. But I agree that, you know, we take, in discussing this, we take this sort of long historical view, this long view of history, and sort of look at what elements are in play, what elements are missing this time. For the people we're actually talking about, the people on the left now, they don't think that the country, that the stakes have ever been higher. They're not comparing this to more problematic eras, more anything. They think this is everything. So they are. So I think
A certain amount of you know, a lack of perspective is necessary if you're going to be a militant in any kind, right?
That's right. Yeah, and that is in play. They have that lack of perspective.
I mean, I don't want to defend the weathermen and SDS and all of that. They were, you know, among the most monstrous creations of, you know, warped ideology this country has ever produced. But, you know, they were living at a time in which America, we think that America is divided. It's so divided and we're so partisanly, look at this and these districts and there's people can't talk to each other. I mean, you had, you know, you literally had America, you had the most advanced form of American domestic terrorism this country ever saw. There were something like 1,500 bombings in, I don't know, 3 or 4 years' time, and you had an entire doctrine on the respectable liberal left that said that America was a was an evil country, and that the people who, traditionalists in the United States, who were not part of the revolutionary movement, were bad. They were hard hat monsters who, you know, who were blocking all kinds of progress, and this assault that was staged on them, on you know, the military, on police, and on you know, on the uniforms that guard us, as Rudyard Kipling called them, was really extreme, and we've seen bits and pieces of it, but nothing on that scale. However, like I say, I don't think it's unthinkable. I mean, the rhetoric is very much the same, even if the reality is not. And so at some point, the reality could be brought up to match the rhetoric. And I'll give you, now to go to the other side, if I could, you know, so we have this America's awful and Trump is horrible and everything is terrible and all of that, right? And sort of the general, we joked on the last show about Sarah Jong, the you know, newly minted New York Times opinion writer, whose entire corpus of opinion on Twitter is about how horrible the country that has made her such a smashing success is, which is, I think, a pretty typical thing. But then, you know, we have like Laura Ingraham on Fox last night saying, quote, "The America we know and love doesn't exist anymore. Massive demographic changes have been foisted on the American people, and they are changes that none of us ever voted for, and most of us don't like. This is related to both illegal and legal immigration," meaning that America is being changed for the worse by the fact that people immigrate to this country, including Laura Ingraham's own three children, by the way, in case you want to vomit right in front of yourself, woman attacking legal and illegal immigrants who has imported three from another country, from other countries, to enjoy the benefits and glories of being an American that she wishes to deny to everybody else who isn't her. Nonetheless, I think we have this conditional rhetoric about the United States now on all sides, right? So the right, Trump did it himself. He said this election's rigged and the whole country is going to be, you know, if the our democracy is going to be ruined if I don't become president, because it means the election's rigged. And Democrats now have their own line about this, which is that gerrymandering and voter suppression line, right? Which is, it's all rigged. Gerrymandering rigged it for the Republicans. Voter suppression rigs it for the Republicans. Now the Republicans are going to have all these judges who are going to rig it. So everyone's looking to say that America is an unjust, unfair, and terrible place. And that is a recipe for social disaster. Maybe not now, but later.
Right. And there's also the element on the left of arguing that there's going to be this, or there is this Trumpian authoritarianism that's going to break up our democratic republic. So right. And that's, you know, there's a rash of books all about this now.
Right.
And that's, you know.
And that, again, I think gives implicit permission for extra legal action to fight authoritarianism. The joke, of course, is that all the passion on that score has always been on the right, right? Like, gotta have guns. What's the main reason you gotta have guns? To protect yourself against an encroaching tyrannical government.
And what is the common leftist argument about that? Oh, please, no one's over. We're not getting any tyrants to overthrow.
Right. So, yeah. So that was fun as long as that lasted.
Yeah.
Getting the So okay.
By the way, so having said this,
yeah.
Then I mean, I maybe want to wait on this question, but I think we need to weigh in on it either way. What happens to the right?
Right.
In light of a...
Okay. So before we do that, I want to tell you guys about Lending Club. For decades, credit cards have been telling us buy it now and pay for it later with interest. Despite your best intentions, that interest can get out of control fast. With Lending Club, you can consolidate your debt or pay off credit cards with one fixed monthly payment. Since 2007, Lending Club has helped millions of people regain control of their finances with affordable fixed-rate personal loans. No trips to a bank, no high-interest credit cards. Just go to LendingClub.com, tell them about yourself and how much you want to borrow, pick the terms that are right for you, and if you're approved, your loan is automatically deposited into your bank account in as little as a few days. Lending Club is the number one peer-to-peer lending platform with over $35 billion in loans issued. So go to LendingClub.com/commentary, check your rate in minutes, and borrow up to $40,000. That's LendingClub.com/commentary. LendingClub.com/commentary. All loans made by WebBank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Okay, so Abe, you start.
Well, I don't
Republicans.
You know, Republicans
in the wake of a Democratic wave in 2018.
Okay, I don't see any either side, frankly, turning back from the ledge. But I certainly. There is absolutely going to be no sort of introspection about on the right about a Republican loss, connecting it to their being too Trumpy, too enthusiastic, too absolutist, too nationalist. I think we're going to see more of all that. I think the blame is going to be on candidates who weren't sufficiently Trumpy. And on the media, and on all the usual suspects, it's going to be more of that. It's going to be turbocharged, more of the same.
The biggest wild card, I guess, is probably, and I guess I think we should get into your column, John, from the Post, which made so many waves, is the extent to which Republicans believe, or are led to believe, or are convinced of the illegitimacy of the results, and the extent to which that has the opposite and equal effect on the Republican right, the really unhinged, steeped in like-minded media aspects of the Republican right. It's a very small segment, by the way. There was a, and just as an aside, to get everybody on the same page, there was an interesting study performed by, sponsored by the guys over at the Monkey Cage blog, which is now on Washington Post, and was a survey, and was a study of Donald Trump's support among Republicans. And the top lines is essentially, the big headline is that Donald Trump's support among people who think that he's, you know, you always hear that Donald Trump is more popular than Reagan among Republicans. And that is true for a segment of the strong Republican-affiliated voter who makes up 16% of the likely voters in 2018, according to this poll. Among another, a broader segment of Republicans, Donald Trump has broad support. It's like 73% support. But he's by no means more popular than Reagan. And that is the broadest segment of the Republican Party, not the fanatical elements who are willing to excuse every single thing Donald Trump says or does. It's the segment of the Republican Party who is convinced that he represents a bulwark against cultural liberalism, against democratic policies, that he is a necessary evil, and that all other evils can be justified by that necessity.
Right. But, you know, also this whole Trump-Reagan thing, just to continue on this tangent, is so ludicrous because the nature of the Republican coalition was very different in the 1980s. And there was still a body of opinion in the Republican Party that could be defined as liberal Republican that did not particularly like Reagan, didn't want him to be president, and didn't fall in line in Trumpian manner. Really until the late 80s, and certainly in 90, if you were going to analogize the first 2 years of Reagan's presidency, Reagan presided over a very serious recession that ended up breaking the back of the inflationary spiral and was very important to the recovery that followed. But, you know, in like September of 1982, Reagan was not popular. And Republicans were hammered in the midterm election in 2018. And the, as I say, the part Reagan's election was not the result of wild support. He didn't win 40 states in 1980 because he had wild Republican support. He won 40 states in 1980 because he had wild Democratic support. Remember, he won 50% of the vote in 1980 when the Republican Party was half the size of the Democratic Party, if you asked people, were they Republicans or Democrats? So, I mean, he may have had wide-scale Republican support, but his secret sauce was was nominal Democratic support that won him victories in places that nobody anticipated. Anyway, let's move off that and talk about the rigging question. So, if the rigging question in Trump's head in 2016 was that there was a sort of deep electoral state that was going to prevent him from winning and rigging the election. So if you want to know where the deep state thought comes from, it's that somehow it's all going to be rigged. Voter fraud and, you know, I don't know what, Democratic secretaries of state in individual states, whatever. And he said he refused to say he would abide by the results of the elections. Well, that became moot because he won the Electoral College and going away and became president. So that quieted him down. And then he impaneled this cockamamie voter fraud panel that, you know, came up with nothing and was finally disbanded. So he can't use, so he can't, if the election is rigged in 2018, he's the rigger. So he can't go with the election being rigged. So what's the Republican excuse going to be for losing when everything's great and, you know, he's making America great again and everybody loves him, even though they don't, but that's what the, you know, craziest of the Trumpkins think. What are they going to say? They're going to say the media did it. Relentless attacks by the media and the media being used by the deep state and by Mueller and by, I don't know, Christopher Steele and the dossier and everything like that, took Trump down. And he was taken down by Jim Acosta and the fake news. And the fake news made me lose. And that's where he stands from now. That's one possibility of where things are for him and the Republicans, is that basically the election will be illegitimate. Now, in 2014... Barack Obama rehearsed a version of the midterm results are illegitimate when Republicans won 9 Senate seats. Do you remember this? He gave a press conference the day after and he said, I do not think that a third of the electorate, which is what turned out, 32% turnout in 2014, third of the electorate goes basically against Democrats. I'm not taking that as a, I don't think that means anything. He basically said, whereas in 2010 he had said, "Oh, we were shellacked," right? He said it was a shellacking, and he acknowledged that it was a shellacking. But in this case, he was like, "Nah, it doesn't mean anything." Yeah, it really didn't mean anything. Look what happened in 2016. It so didn't mean anything. So didn't mean anything that, you know, that he could have, if he had been a different and more visionary politician, he could have seen the writing on the wall and said, "Uh-oh." All the heat and all the energy here is in the other guy's camp, and if we nominate, you know, this neurasthenic crook with the emails, maybe we're going to be making a mistake, and we should look elsewhere for our candidate. But he did not have that capacity.
I think what's going to be really interesting is this is going to be the first time that we're going to get to see to what extent Donald Trump considers a failure that's associated, that he should be associated with, but that is not him personally, to see how much he actually cares. Is this going to be the Donald Trump of, hey, it's not the conservative party, it's called the Republican Party. I can do what I want and they can do what they want. Or to what extent is his ego going to be wrapped up in this?
I guess the closest that we would get to that was his performance after he lost the Iowa caucuses. Which was actually rather gracious. He kind of just blew it off, I suppose, is something that, you know, happens. He hadn't gotten a taste of winning yet at that point. So we really haven't. Wait, we haven't really seen
it. Did he blow off? Wasn't that the whole thing where he said that Ted Cruz was so mean to Herman Cain? And
I recall his speech.
I remember there being one shockingly gracious speech about the great people of Iowa.
But then he changed because Ted Cruz stole it from poor Ben Carson. Remember? Ted Cruz's campaign manager tweeted something out, and then they took it back, and then it was poor Ben Carson.
So he hadn't had a chance to watch enough television yet to get radicalized.
Okay, well, I think we don't know the answer to your question, Abe. That is, I think we'll know in October. In other words, if the writing is on the wall in October that they're going to lose, he's going to separate himself, and he will not. The writing is on the wall now.
What's he tweeting? Red wave. Have you seen this?
Yeah, but the red wave tweets are not. That's not the writing on the wall. What I mean is, if basically, look, the word was that starting in June, the bottom started to fall out in district after in private polling and House district after district, and in some of the Senate races and stuff like that, the bottom began to fall out. There was this moment when the generic ballot that measures, you know, whether you say you'll vote for a Republican or a Democrat was closing. At one point, it closed in some polls to 4 points, and now it's back to 9 or 10 in most of them. And apparently, there is this slow motion meltdown going on in some of these districts. He's saying he wants to go out and campaign 6 days a week. He's saying he wants rally 6 days a week. They're saying maybe they'll send Ivanka, or they'll send Donald Jr., they'll send this one, they'll send all these surrogates to try to nationalize the race and get people going. But I'm saying, like, if the data in mid-September say, you know, head for the hills, does he want to associate himself with all that defeat? I don't know. Does he want to go campaign for people who are going to lose?
Right, not a shot. I mean, he's changed his tune after the fact before, right? Hasn't he disowned associated losses? I forget who was it that
Luther
he,
Strange.
Right. Yeah. Well, it wasn't, you know.
He deleted all those tweets.
Right. Yeah.
And he was weak.
Yeah. Right.
He was a nice guy, but weak. Right. You know, like that. Okay. But I don't know. I mean, look. The problem for Trump is that if there were a way that he could forestall the Democratic wave, he should be up all night for the next 2 months doing it, because he should want the Democrats to lose by one, so that House committees do not end up majority Democratic, so that they will be investigating every nook and cranny of his administration, and ultimately so that he is not impeached, because that would be bad, unless it wouldn't be bad. Now, there is a theory out there that says that his impeachment would be the ultimate polarizing strategy that would get the right and Republicans to rally behind him as never before. And there is one piece of evidence to suggest that's true, and that was Clinton's impeachment, where Clinton's impeachment had the perverse effect not of driving people from Clinton because he was so tainted, but rather rallying to his defense because of negative partisanship in the late 1990s, where people said, if we let this happen, Newt Gingrich and the religious right and all these terrible Republicans will control everything forever, and they'll take away your abortions, and they'll take away your, whatever progressive things you want. And so Clinton must be defended at all costs. And I think you can see where Republicans might say, we have to defend Trump at all costs, because this is the last gasp of the liberal media, you know, collegiate, academic, urban conspiracy, and if they impeach him, then, you know, they win and we lose, and we can't allow that to happen. No, you think that impeachment would be bad because it would separate some Republicans from Trump.
Well, the conditions I envision in which that scenario becomes even thinkable ensures that there have to be some people who peel off. They would have to be so serious. And it's not just, I mean, we in, around
You're
this
saying
table
the charges of impeachment, the articles of impeachment would have to be so serious that some Republicans would
people
agree with
in our circles think the Democrats are just going to bring articles of impeachment for whatever, eating a ham sandwich backwards. there's no evidence that that's going to be the case. There are Democrats who want that to happen, but there are Democrats who matter, who are in a position to execute that directive. People like Jerry Nadler are on TV saying, we don't have the goods yet. And it would be extremely irresponsible for us to bring articles of impeachment because we don't like the guy, like what Al Green does every 3 weeks and put articles of impeachment before Democrats, and it just goes nowhere. That's kind of the thing that I expect to happen. And in the event that they have something serious enough that they can bring articles, they would do so with the understanding that they would have to peel off enough Republicans to bring something that is legitimate. They could not put a party line vote before the House on articles.
Good. Totally disagree with you in every possible respect here. If Democrats have the votes to impeach, they will impeach him for picking his toenails in Poughkeepsie. That is the logic of the Democratic position. Whatever Trump is, he is illegitimate. He should not be president. He's not illegitimate maybe in the Electoral College is now, from in the view of many of them, illegitimate. Therefore, he's illegitimate prima facie because he didn't win the popular vote. You can't impeach on that maybe. Well, you can impeach on anything because there's a high crime and misdemeanor is undefined in the Constitution. And I think that the logic of the Democratic caucus and the Democratic Party will require, and I think you said this a couple months ago, that's why I'm a little surprised to hear you saying this now, that will require them to impeach him. Even if it's a mistake, you can say, excuse me, you could make the argument that the impeachment of Clinton was a terrible mistake by the Republicans, but they did it anyway because they had to, because they had gone too far down the road in the view that Clinton was a uniquely horrible moral example in the White House. And so I don't know if they win by one vote, they can't do it. But if they win by 10 or more, not only can they, but they will. And maybe it'll be serious. Maybe the charges will be very serious. Maybe Mueller will issue a report that will give them total grounds on which to make a serious argument that he should be removed from
office. I suppose that's where my bias is.
But I
expect there to be something substantial enough to generate a real charge to pursue impeachment.
But Republicans will still not vote for it.
If there is, so that's the trap.
No, Republicans don't have to vote for it in the House if there are enough Democrats to vote for it in the Senate, because I don't think did the Clinton impeachment get a single Democratic vote?
I mean, that expects a purely partisan process, and I don't imagine
that's what happened
that
in the Clinton impeachment. Hold on.
I don't imagine that it will be a purely partisan process in my mind, because what I imagine is that the articles that will be brought in the event of a condition that leads Democrats to make a real charge on this, and not just because the activist base is demanding it. And I should say that I do believe that the activist base will demand that of Democrats, and they will comply in some fashion or form, but I don't necessarily think it will pass the House. If it is a superfluous, like I said, that they would have to take a vote. And I think they would have to take a vote. I don't expect articles to pass the House on simply a party line vote.
Okay, so let's just go to the Clinton impeachment. 5 Democrats voted in favor of 3 of the 4 articles of impeachment. They were Virgil Good of Virginia, Ralph Hall of Texas, Paul McHale of Pennsylvania, Charlie Stenholm of Texas, and Gene Taylor of Mississippi. My guess is that none of those districts is now represented by a Democrat any longer. 8 Republicans voted against Sherwood Bullard of New York, Mike Castle of Delaware, Phil English of Pennsylvania, Nancy Johnson of Connecticut, Jay Kim of California, Jim Leach of Iowa, Ralph Regula of Ohio. He was only impeached on 2 of the 4 charges brought against him. But it was pretty much a party line vote. And I don't think that the trial in the Senate, there was not a single Republican vote, a Democratic vote against when he was acquitted. I'm sorry. Let me just find the acquittal numbers here, if I could. Ay, ay, ay. Sorry, this is boring. Someone sing. Yeah, the perjury charge was defeated 45 to 55. That basically the obstruction of justice charge was defeated 50-50, and that was with a Republican Senate. So in fact, a bunch of Republican senators voted against removal from office, and no Democrat voted for any of the impeachment removal charges in the Senate.
To connect this,
so
to
that was a partisan. That was a partisan impeachment.
To connect this to the first half of the podcast, what happens? Is there an explosion on the activist left in the event of no removal of Trump?
No, because
it depends.
I think
it depends on what we're
okay. It depends.
But let's say, don't know what the charges are.
Okay, let's say that the charges are not sufficient to are insufficient to make it a open and shut case that he should be removed, and that Republicans will only be protecting him for their own craven partisan reasons if they don't vote for it.
Right.
The impeachment will be baked in the cake. That is to say, they will understand that this is being done as a gigantic version of a Senate resolution of condemnation, except in the House, right? And there'll be some ridiculous trial where everybody's wearing robes, like William Rehnquist designed this robe because he'd seen a production of Gilbert and Sullivan's Iolanthe, and so he had the robe that they he had seen in this production. So they'll the Senate, the Supreme Court will preside. There'll be a thing. It'll be over. That'll be the end of it. But they will say, well, this was a success because the country heard the case and da 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 da. I don't think anyone. My guess is no one will be disappointed. Everybody will say on all their favorite shows that if in the scenario that he's it's not an open and shut case that he should be removed, that he won't be removed, and that this is the purpose of this is a moral expression of disgust and outrage, and that will happen. Similar, and then some of our friends on the right will of course use this to say the deep state is, well, this is a coup attempt. Absolutely. This is the deep state, this is the liberals, and you know, they must be stopped, they must be. Now here's the question that we can tie to the first. Paul Neelan, the racist, anti-Semitic piece of dung from Wisconsin, and his friends and all the people like that, could they be stimulated to acts of violence in the course of an impeachment proceeding on the grounds that, you know, the deep state is now, this is a coup attempt and they need to counteract the coup attempt?
I find it tough to believe, only because the people that we've seen on the right who are moved to acts of violence are two types of people, and they often probably overlap in the Venn diagram. One is the alt-right, the white nationalist-branded alt-right, and they're so far outside the mainstream that it's very difficult to call them the right. And the second is like the pizza gators. The right is...
And the pizza, one of the pizza gators shot up
that's
the Comet Pizzeria.
That's what I'm referring to. The right is composed... more as a coalition, is more composed of people who just don't, they're not sign holders. They don't get out in the street. They're not activists, much less so than the left. There's much less potential, therefore, for violence from the right than there is from the left. Not none, but it wouldn't come from the really reliable Republican voter. It would come from somebody who's already pretty far outside the mainstream. And would it ignite mass episodes of violence from people who are on the right? I think it's, the potential there is very limited.
I mean, you never underestimate the ability of one crazy person to do an enormous amount of damage that seems to crystallize, you know, the views of everybody. Remember that Bill Clinton turned his own political fortunes around in part as a result of the actions of Timothy McVeigh. Like, he was on the ropes. Everyone assumed he was dead, that he was politically dead, couldn't win in 1996. And then Timothy McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City and was revealed to be this, you know, denizen of the far right. And Clinton said, oh, look at this country. We have to come together. Rush Limbaugh is making us all hate each other and all of that. And the right was thrown on its heels. Like the lack of social media and stuff like that. Everybody was so shocked by what happened in Oklahoma City that there was no real rallying ability to counteract the Clinton message. And Clinton made a powerful speech, and he looked like a uniter and not a divider, and that was the beginning of his road to recovery. So I can't even remember why I brought this up, except to say that violence is it only takes one.
Right.
It only takes one guy. Or in McVeigh's case, two guys, actually. But...
No, for mass violence, it takes more than that. The potential to catalyze a mass violence a mass movement that is a violent movement. I think there's just a slightly more limited potential for that on the right than the left.
There is literally no history in the United States, if I think of it, of right-wing rioting. There's a lot of left-wing rioting, and some of it is very romanticized left. The Haymarket riots of the 1886, and various other including mass demonstrations and all. Mass demonstrations are a species of the right. That is not the way the right handles things. It's more the way the left handles things. Even the Tea Party, mobilizations were, they cleaned up after themselves, right. And they picnicked, and there were some speeches, and they handed out constitutions, and they went away. It wasn't like 500,000 people, on the mall.
And that's distinct from paramilitary activity. It's just the mob, the riot.
I mean, the innovations on the right in the Trump age have all really been about Trump importing a lot of behaviors and ideas that were on the left into the right.
They were on the left mixed with the crowds at World Wrestling Federation.
That's right.
So you sort of put them together, sort of left-wing politics with people throwing chairs at each other.
Exactly.
In a fronton in West
Hartford. So I think the question of whether or not we see right-wing mimicking of left-wing violence in that type of violence is completely open.
But it's almost irrelevant, though. Yeah, because in the event that there was some sort of act of right-wing violence, which is particularly completely, you can completely see it happening, some sort of alt-right violence or
we saw it last year in Charlottesville. It wasn't really a riot, but because there weren't that many people involved in it.
Yeah. So in the event of that kind of an act, you can see how that would be used to tar the right, and the right would be on its back foot. And even though it wasn't a part of a mass movement, it wouldn't even ignite a mass movement, it had no appeal to a mass movement, it would be used to justify attacks on the entire right as being, the impetus behind that sort of violence, the reason why you have that sort of violence. Right. And that would probably have a stigmatizing effect along the lines of 95.
So basically, we're just making crap up because this is all like speculative fiction. But if they can have The Handmaid's Tale, we can have our scenarios, And no one's given us Emmys for this podcast, unfortunately. Though I would accept one if anybody wanted to. Now that they're going to nominate popular movie, now they're adding popular movie as a category in the Oscars to Best Picture. Then we're going to have Best Popular Movie. Maybe you missed that.
I did. So what is it? What is it? What is it?
We don't know what it means. Okay. It means basically Disney gets to win an award every year.
I see.
Because it's, in other words, you'll have the best pictures.
It wasn't good enough.
Then you'll have the pictures that make the best picture that made a lot of money. It's one of the dumbest ideas ever.
Because all those movies got, when they got Academy Awards, they weren't the televised ones. They got the they got the awards that were like technical.
Is it supposed to be equivalent of pop music? Like there is a best pop album, best pop song.
No, because pop is a different kind. This is literally how many people went to go see it.
Yeah, no. In other words, they're going to have to figure out how to categorize such a thing because there are basically it's like the commentary podcast would win Popular Podcast of the Year, and Jonah Goldberg's Remnant would win Niche Podcast of the Year, I think. Charming Niche Podcast of the Year. Just to try to establish the categories. Just to make that clear. So we are like Black Panther, and he is like Moonlight. Okay? That's really the distinction here between Jonah's podcast and ours. So now that we have established that, and it's incredibly hot in this studio today, we will say goodbye to you till next week. For Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and the absent and dearly missed Sourab Amari today, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.